head off to the airport to pick up Michael Whitman, so I don't know whether you'll actually be here, it's just a talk today. And also, I'll give you information about the barbecue location later on. So there's a barbecue to remind you, from 7 o'clock onwards, and it will be near the RSIRC building where there's an undercover barbecue. Thank you, Ralph.
Okay. Good morning. So I'm going to start where we left off yesterday. I hope somebody remembers what we were talking about yesterday. Just in case you don't, we were going to do. We basically yesterday did a very brief introduction to planning, and then looked at a variety of track that the work in learning in planning has taken. And in particular, we are in this big one, which is talking about learning search control. And we started looking at, we first looked at the fact that knowledge-based planning planners, where humans write the knowledge, do extremely well compared to even the current best state-of-the-art domain-independent planners, which only have domain physics with them. And so that sort of opens up the possibility that learning techniques can be used to improve the planning performance. And so we looked at the kinds of knowledge that people have written, handwritten, and then we started looking at how some of the sorts of knowledge that actually can be automatically learned right now. And as I mentioned yesterday, not everything that is actually written by humans is yet learnable. So there are certain types of knowledge, in fact, such as hierarchical task networks. They are not yet, there are no effective algorithms right now, effective techniques for learning HTMs well, okay? However, I can at least tell you the kinds of things that we already know how to do, and then the rest would be open, so you get to do it. And then we will, of course, after that is over, we'll look at learning domain knowledge itself. If you don't have domain physics information, how do you learn that? And then end with situations where you have both, you are sort of faced with partial domain knowledge, and so you're trying to learn both the domain knowledge and the search control at the same time. And that's pretty much open right now. Okay. So we were staring at this, and in fact, I just wanted to, this was learning from failure using explanation-based learning techniques. We just started talking about it last time, and I just got this Honda advertisement thing on my mail. Apparently, they took that particular advertisement that you took, 2 hours, a two-minute long advertisement, 606 times in real time, and 605 times, at least one of the things went wrong, and the 606th time it worked. So I don't know whether they actually learned anything from their failures, but I thought it was an interesting idea here that connects up. So in this case, we were talking about a specific search control, a search branch in some planning problem, where it turned out that this particular branch failed, and what you want to learn is some sort of a choice rule which tells the learner, which tells the planner that don't ever get into this branch again. Okay, and we were talking about this point that if you can somehow explain why this guy failed, and if the explanation is smaller than the entire plan here, which is very important. In fact, if the explanation of your failure is yourself, or if your explanation of a plan's failure is all the constraints in the plan, then that really doesn't get you anything. Okay, if there is a subset in this plan constraints that can actually be used to explain why the plan failed, then you can sort of reason through the search tree looking at, so for example, in this case, this branch failed because, this is actually a partial order planner scenario, this branch failed because you are trying to make a step zero come before one, but a step one is already supposed to come before zero. And it turns out those two constraints are violated, and those two constraints are inconsistent. And so that's the smallest explanation of failure for this branch where this this plan has been extended. And there is another similar failure explanation there. And all what you're doing right now is take these explanations of failure, back up the tree, trying to figure out who is to be blamed and under what conditions should you not have gotten into this branch to begin with. So this is an example of learning search control using this kind of analysis. So for example, as I mentioned yesterday, a rule that you could learn here is, in fact, the sort of rule that you would learn here would say that, you know, something like this, so that if you are trying to achieve an open condition polished at some particular step, and the thing is already polished, and don't try to use rolling operation to support cylindrical. Okay, so that essentially winds up being the reason why this branch ultimately died at the top level. So the failure here has been actually propagated back. Okay, so that's an example, one single example of explanation-based learning of search control using failure. And I'll say a little bit more about the general EBL, which I actually mentioned yesterday. Partly, I guess, because you don't see, I don't think we talked about it in any of the lectures in the school here. So basically, you start with a labeled example and some background domain theory, and you're trying to explain using the background theory why the example deserves the label. Okay? So for example, previously, this is a plan, this is an example, and its label was fail, and you're trying to explain why that was the case. Using the background knowledge. And then, so in some sense, you can think of this explanation process as a feature selection part of a learning algorithm. So of the many possible features that this particular example has, which are the ones that are most relevant to the label it has? And then you use this explanation to generalize the example, and then to learn either search control knowledge. So in fact, this idea has been used in multiple ways within planning, and of course it's been used in machine learning separately for all sorts of other things. Within planning, it's been used, given a correct plan for some initial and goal state pair, learn a generalized plan, which sort of works for a class of such problems. Okay, we'll look at an example of that. Or given a search tree with some failing subtrees, learn rules that can predict those sorts of failures, so that you can stop the failure from happening from upfront. Are given a stored plan and the situations where it could not be reused, learn the rules, conditions under which you would never retrieve it. So for example, one of the things that we look at is this notion of reusing plans, where you'll store lots and lots of old plans in some library and a new problem comes. You are trying to pick a subset of these stored plans and trying to extend it to solve the new problem. This is sort of instance-based, or in this case, case-based learning in planning. And you know, it would be nice to be able to tell that a particular plan which looks syntactically applicable would ultimately lead you to failure. And again, when it's not actually extendable, you can learn the reasons why are the conditions under which you should not really be retrieving this plan. Again, the same sorts of analysis could be useful there. So, coming back to EBL of search control rules based on failure that we just mentioned earlier, the sort of analysis that goes on here is, suppose you have a plan and there is something incomplete about this plan, so you're trying to extend it, and in this particular case, there is some particular flaw that you're trying to remove, and you took some decisions and led to some plans, and all those plans failed, and this is a decision choice here. Either you can deal with this flaw either by D2, D1, or Dn, and it turns out all of them failed, in which case you provided explanations for all of these using your background knowledge as to why these plans are failing plans, and then you regress these. So what must have been the case before this decision was taken, such that after the decision you would have this failure feature in the example. So that's essentially what happens in terms of how you found, so basically you took these explanations and regressed it over these decisions, and at the top. And then you also, it turns out that almost as a byproduct, you get to, even though in at the lower levels you have explanations in terms of actual constants in the plan, as part of this process you can generalize away constants. You can tell actually based on the explanations when are the constants generalizable and when they're not. Okay, so you wound up actually learning here not if you want to polish a specific block, instead you're saying if you want to polish any block, then this rule would hold. Okay. A couple of interesting things on search control loop learning using this sort of explanation-based analysis is that in the example that I showed you earlier, it's quite easy to see. I mean, well, if you kind of can look at this small print, you can see that the reason this plan fails is because there is a circular ordering, and circular orderings make no sense. Okay. Oftentimes, what happens is as you're searching, there is no obvious two constraints that are violated, and there's a small subset of constraints which can be shown to be inconsistent. Okay. So you don't have a very short explanation. And basically, the branch just went through some depth limit, and you lost your patience, and you went out of the branch. So in that case, in a way, this branch is failing in the sense that you went too far in that branch with nothing really happening, no actual plan coming up. But you don't get to have a nice, cozy explanation as to why this plan failed. Okay. One interesting thing, of course, is that explanation, basically, in such cases, the important thing to remember is you can explain based on, it doesn't have to be that the explanations are about a couple of constraints that directly lead to inconsistency. It could be with respect to any background knowledge that you have. So for example, when my car doesn't work, I tend to explain why it doesn't work. And my explanations are bogus most of the time. I have no clue why cars work, okay? And yet, that doesn't stop me from explaining why my car isn't working. And to the extent my explanations of why my car isn't working are anywhere close to reality, they help me. So for example, even I know that the color of my car has nothing to do with it's not starting. Okay? And so I would never repaint my car just because it's not running. Okay? Whereas I might not know something about the specific connection between the spark plugs and something thingamajig is missing. That's the reason the car isn't working. And so if I don't have that exact explanation, so my explanation may not be completely correct, but with respect to the background knowledge I have an explanation which is sort of a selection of features in the current example as to why it deserves that label. So in this example, what happened is a plan is going further down the depth limit, and you could not find any obvious explanation of correct failure in terms of a specific set of constraints that are directly opposite to each other, saying circularity of ordering or something like that. However, if you have some background domain knowledge, you can, for example, such as you have an axiom which says, in blocks world, if you have on XY, then clear Y cannot be true. Just given the domain physics of blocks world, if X is on top of Y, these are the small blocks where each block takes only one block on top of it. Okay. In that case, if on XY is true, clear Y cannot be true. Okay, this is a background knowledge. Now, if you have that background knowledge, you can actually explain that this particular plan is going to die, even though you don't see that explanation. It's going to die because it turns out that this step, which can come somewhere in between these two steps, will require clear B to be true just before it. And we have made some sort of a commitment saying from here to here on AB will be true. And so that commitment is inconsistent with what needs to be true here. So that would wind up becoming your explanation. And so that's one way you actually can learn the search control rules, even though you don't have obvious couple of constraints that are inconsistent with each other directly. Okay. So in this kind of scenario, what you have is the domain knowledge plus some subset of constraints in the plan lead to entail false. Okay, and if the domain knowledge is bogus, then it will still lead to false, and that will tell you which are the features of the plan you're going to concentrate on. Okay, in general, I think even this particular case, it turns out that the explanation I gave you is correct. For blocks world, this is in fact correct. Okay, so it turns out that you can never have on X, Y, and clear Y to be true at any single instance in the domain. Now, what's more interesting is I would like to actually do what would be more useful is to have to deal with a partially correct explanation. In complex domains, like such as my car, I have no real clue of giving a complete and correct explanation as to why my car isn't working. And in general, I think the some of the work that, again, got restarted in this EBL community, knowledge-based learning community, involves providing partially correct explanations of failure and using them to learn. Okay, so that sort of, originally when EBL came about, it was seen as it requires complete and correct explanations of the as to why the example deserves that label. But now we think of it more as it's just a feature selection step. And feature selection steps basically are providing you some reason as to why you believe of the many features of the example, this subset are more relevant in explaining its label. We can also explain and generalize success. So previously I've been looking at failure. In general, all you care about is an example and a label, and you want to explain why that example deserves that label. That's what you want to do. So in this particular case, I have a plan, and so I made it in such a way that for this particular scenario, I want A to be on top of B and C to be on top of D, and some planner gave me an actual totally ordered plan which says you put A on B and then put C on D and then you're done. That's the ordering that it gave. And when you explain why this plan is successful, okay, you would be able to actually generalize it to say that pretty much for this class of initial states and goal states, this plan would work. So in particular, you actually notice that not only are the constants generalized away, you also have the ordering has gone now. The ordering can be made partial now, because the specific planner the planner generated a totally ordered plan, but that wasn't really needed. It turns out that this could have been done in any order, and you would still have been correct. Okay. One interesting thing to notice is success explanations tend to involve more components of the plan than failure explanations. Oftentimes you could have a very large complex plan, and the reason why it fails could be very small set of subset of constraints in the plan. Whereas oftentimes, if there's a long plan, and unless it's highly non-minimal that you wound up adding unnecessary steps into the plan, the planner wound up adding unnecessary steps into the plan, oftentimes pretty much everything in the plan winds up playing a role in making sure that the plan is correct. So in this example, actually, it turned out that this was ordering was an unnecessary ordering, and because the planner did put it in, you could remove it. Okay, so that's something kind of an interesting point, that explanations of success tend to be longer than explanations of failure. Now, how do you actually explain? I didn't mention it there. In the case of planning, the domain, the background knowledge in essence, meta knowledge in essence, says that a plan would be correct if every goal is supported by somebody, and for that person, and for every step in the plan, if it has any preconditions, somebody else is supporting them, such that those support structures are not violated. Okay, so nobody else is coming in between. So you actually prove this explanation on your plan, and whichever features of the plan take part in that explanation, those are the only relevant features that explain why it is successful, and the rest can be removed. So you sort of have selected a subset of required features. So there's been a lot of work in explanation-based search control rule learning pre-1995. Remember I said there was like a big increase in performance of domain-independent planners after 1995. Before that, there was a lot of work which showed that the planners could be improved significantly using EBL analysis. And more recently, I think, as I said, in general, the interest in speeding up using learning techniques has reduced. But there has been some examples, at least, where I think, for example, there's a planner which I won't even discuss called GraphPlan. And right now, most implementations of GraphPlan wind up using some sort of explanation-based learning from failures to improve performance. And that seems to work quite well. But it basically uses EBL almost as explanations, a correct and complete explanations of failure. But I want you to understand that, in general, if you have background knowledge, it sort of focuses you as to what part of your big example can be blamed for its label, can be credited for its label. Okay, and if you're wrong, it's still be it's like saying the feature selection step is wrong. That's basically it. Since I spend this much time talking about EBL, I want to say a few things about which I might have caused the misconceptions to you in your mind, or if you read about this in literature, in the older literature, this sort of stuff comes up. So one is, the idea that maybe explanation-based learning needs complete and correct background knowledge. As I mentioned in my car example, you don't need it. Okay? So your explanations are as good as your background knowledge. And to the extent you have any background knowledge that you believe in, it focuses your learning effort. Okay? So in fact, I think that sort of confounds the inductive versus analytical dimension with knowledge-rich versus knowledge-poor dimension of learning. Okay, so if you have background knowledge, you want to use it in general, you know, and unless your background knowledge is completely buggy, why would you not want to use it? So if you do have complete and correct knowledge, then the learned knowledge will be in the deductive closure of the original knowledge. So if you just had a big theorem prover and it just kept spewing out all the deductively entailed knowledge from the existing set of knowledge, then if you had complete and correct explanations originally, then everything you learn would be in the deductive closure. If not, it won't be in the deductive closure. So it's more like the inductive learning, where you always are making jumps from what you know to what you don't know. Okay. So again, I think the idea of thinking of this as a feature selection step is a useful one. The second thing is that EBL is sort of competing with inductive learning. I don't think it's that much in vogue right now, but there was a time when people would actually think about it this way. And as I say, you know, think of it as a feature selection step for any learning algorithm, and you don't have that problem in there. The third thing, which actually comes up in several descriptions of EBL, if you look at any textbook level descriptions, is somehow knowledge is a bad thing because knowledge was used in EBL and EBL had utility problems. What was utility problem? It turns out that if you learn a whole bunch of rules of, if you learn a whole bunch of rules of this form, saying don't take this choice if the following is true, don't take this choice if the following is true, and then you have now a humongous library of, you know, critiques saying don't do this, don't do this, don't do this, don't do that, and whenever you have a new plan, you are looking at your large library of all the do's and don'ts to see whether or not you should take a step. Okay, and if there are too many of these rules, you could be spending your lifetime matching the left-hand side of the rule just to see whether it even is applicable. Okay, now this has nothing to do with explanation-based learning per se. In general, any search control knowledge which is organized in terms of giving you bunches of rules, you know, you have to match those rules. If you have a large number of plans that you stored in your library so that you could reuse them to solve new problems, if the plan library becomes very large, then, you know, if I'm giving you a very small problem to solve, you'd be spending time looking into this very large library trying to see whether or not, you know, the right plan for it there in the library. Okay. So I think the utility problem is a real one, but it's a real one for, in general, any sort of search control knowledge. It has nothing to do with knowledge-based versus non-knowledge-based learning. Okay. So that's basically what I wanted to say. And on the EBL part, one other thing, actually, I think something that we hopefully will touch on as I end this lecture today is one thing that would be useful is, you know, if you want to learn complex things with fewer examples, with very few examples, you just have to use background knowledge. I mean, there's a classic quote which I just forgot right now. I think it was in the old Winston AI textbook that the humans basically only learn those things that we almost already know. Okay, this is exactly the reason why you are not taught kernel methods when you're in the grade one. They sort of made you go through your entire life story, I mean, a various number of classes, and then they taught you kernel methods, and you say, oh yeah, that makes sense. Okay, so background knowledge is very important if you want to learn from very small number of examples. Okay, so one question, of course, is how do you use this background knowledge when the background knowledge is not complete? No, after all, I mean, the learning, you are trying to get the background knowledge, but at the same time, if it is already there, everything that you need to learn is in the deductive closure. So one of the interesting kinds of ideas would be to sort of characterize what parts of the explanation of a concept you are sure of and what parts you are not sure of. Okay, so an idea is that I might not know everything about how cars work, but my knowledge about specific sub-assemblies of cars might be complete enough that when I give you a part of explanation which involves that sub-assembly of the car, then in essence, actually, I'm complete on that. So there's this whole notion of characterizing local completeness of your knowledge and using that to decide how much of your, rather than say explanation is completely correct or not completely correct, I can say, here is the explanation, these parts I'm completely sure, these parts I'm less sure. And then you can use that in a much more interesting feature selection way. I think that's a good direction for EBL. In general, the way I used EBL here is as sort of, there are various terms that have been used in the machine learning literature, including EBL, KBL, RBL, relevance-based learning, knowledge-based learning, explanation-based learning. I just meant all of, I mean, I used the word EBL here, the abbreviation EBL here to stand for all of those. Okay. So that gets me, so I basically was looking at this big picture and I learned rules to guide choice points and I did that using explanation-based analysis. Now I want to say a couple of things about this and this and then go to the other slide. So I sort of have been mentioning earlier that one other way you can improve planner performance is to remember plans. Remember old plans, remember pieces of old plans, and when a new problem comes along, either, you know, you basically, instead of solving it from scratch, you try to reuse these plans. Now there's been a whole bunch of work that's been done in this area. Many, many different ways of doing this sort of reuse. And I cannot possibly explain to you all the possible finer distinctions. So instead, I'll just give you some of the main dimensions along which this sort of differs. And so one, of course, is the structures being reused. So if you're talking about reusing plans, are you talking about reusing an opaque plan? That means if you take it, you have to take the whole thing. You don't get to change anything in the middle, okay? Or are you allowed to modify the pieces of the plan? Okay, so if you're allowed to modify the pieces of the plan, in essence, I take the first five steps of the old plan, add some more things, and add some more new steps, and then bring back the rest of the plan. So it turns out that one is called macro operators, the other is called plan reuse. And similarly, are you just using the solution, which is the plan that has been stored, or are you using the solving process too, the decisions that were made in generating this plan? And finally, the second issue is whether these plans are given to you by hand, by humans outside of the loop, okay, or these are plans that you, the planner, has generated in the past and you're just storing. And this is an interesting dimension because if it's automatically acquired, in the sense you solve these problems in the past, then at least you know exactly why these plans are correct because you have enough domain knowledge to explain them. Whereas if these are given by humans, oftentimes, in fact, in real world, reuse occurs because we don't actually know how to make this plan from scratch. So you take something that somebody else has made, and we make small tweaks and hope that local tweaks won't affect the correctness too much. So that's the kind of way I change my car. You know, I might change it. I don't know how to make it from scratch, but I might change the color of the car, assuming that won't change too much. Okay, so. That's another important thing. So in the area of what's called case-based planning, both have been considered. So both the issue for humans giving it from outside versus automatically acquired. And it turns out that this, let's see, where is it? So it turns out that if it's given by humans, then in essence, the planner doesn't even need to have the complete domain knowledge. And then in terms of mechanics of reuse, if you use these as operators or are you using them as multiple plans, and if you have them multiple plans being coming out of the library, how are you going to put them into the extension process? Okay. Here's just an example, of the kinds of work that's been done in reuse. This is because I actually am familiar with it. In this particular case, you were using derivational traces, which are essentially not only the plan, but the decisions that were taken to get to that plan, okay? And furthermore, when you have a long plan, you don't necessarily remember the entire plan as a single case. If this plan was, let's say, supporting 15 goals, G1 to G15, and it turns out that those goals are all independent, that means if you actually worked each of the goals separately and got the plan, you could have concatenated them to solve all the 15. Then it makes no sense to remember a plan for G1 to G15, another plan for G1 to G14, another plan for G1 to G13, and so on. It makes much more sense to just cut the plan into pieces which are corresponding to independent subproblems. So you could do that independent subproblem analysis again using explanations of why the plan is correct and see whether the explanations are interacting. Explanations of correctness for independent sub-goals are interacting. Okay. And then finally, when you store the plan in the library and it's been retrieved, if in fact you wound up trying to start with that plan and tried to extend it and the branch failed and you had to come out of it, then you try to analyze why that branch failed and remember a sort of a retrieval rule saying under these conditions, don't ever retrieve this plan again, okay? Which is sort of like a search control rule, except it's like a retrieval control rule now. So saying these plans should not be retrieved under those conditions. One thing to mention, I guess, in terms of the EBL and the reuse are kind of closely connected. One interesting thing to kind of mention here is that the question of how eager are you in generalizing the plans that you're storing. In reuse, you can throw away all the plans in specific forms without actually, you know, generalizing the constants into variables and do the mapping at the reuse time. And in EBL, search control rules, you tend to do the generalization upfront. So it's sort of a learning time versus planning time trade-off. I mentioned this yesterday. In fact, there is a planner called MacroFF, which took part in the International Planning Competition in 2004, which basically uses a very simple form of reuse where it just remembers opaque macros, but only two-step macros, not more than two steps. And it remembers those, and it does reasonably sophisticated analysis of if you remember them, would they pay for their cost? In the sense, if you were to keep this as a macro operator, you're increasing the branching factor. So they do a reasonable amount of analysis to make sure that the branching factor increase isn't going to eat into the depth reduction in terms of solution depth. And with that, they were actually, even with this simple idea of two-step macros, they could actually beat FF, which is a very good domain-independent planner. Okay, so they started on top of FF, added some more macro operators, and they were able to beat that. However, one interesting point is, at that time, they were actually able to go from domain-independent planners to much better performance, but then human-retained knowledge planners, they are still much faster. But it turns out by 2004, they were so good that they were not entering competition. So human-retained knowledge still is a goal that's worth learning automatically. Okay. Another way of improving the planner speed up is to learn adjustments to the planner heuristics. We saw yesterday that most of the current planners, the reason they actually seem to work very well is because they do this approximate reachability analysis where for every state they try to compute a number which tells them how far is that state from the goal state, okay, using this reachability analysis. And in doing this reachability, they obviously do approximate versions. They ignore all sorts of interactions, negative interactions. And this turns out to be good in most cases, but it's been noticed that in some domains, ignoring these negative interactions between actions can make the heuristic be severely underestimating. That means the cost of actually going from this state to the goal state may be infinity, but you think it's 7, okay, because you're ignoring the negative interactions. I mean, it may not be in some cases it may not be that fantastically far away. It might be, you know, 20 is the real cost and your approximate analysis says 4, you know, 7 is the real cost. And to the extent you are wrong, you will wind up taking the wrong branches and wasting time. This has been noticed in the, you know, in the planning community and, you know, there are bunches of actually planners which try to improve on this approximate reachability in sort of a static form. So you say that under these conditions, for domains with these kinds of characteristics, do this extra negative interaction analysis. So the normal way that works out here, and I don't expect you to understand this slide, all it does is you try to take the relaxed plan and add some extra number which corresponds to the negative interaction analysis. And in fact, there were planners which worked much better than FF, including, I think, another planner called Downward, which in essence can be seen, its success can be seen as taking negative interactions into account in an opportune fashion. Okay. Now, one idea, if that is the case, then one idea would be, so you could either statically adjust the heuristics so that they take more information into account, or just dynamically learn to predict the difference between what the relaxed plan heuristic is saying and what is the real number. Okay, and that would be just a direct, inductive learning sort of an idea. And this is something that, I just want to talk a little bit about because it seems to work quite well. There's a paper that's coming up in this year's planning conference, ICAPS. So what they do basically is pretty much what I said, and these are some of the details. So you start with a set of training examples, basically problems and their plans that FF or some planner has generated. And then for each example, for each state S on this plan, remember a plan is a sequence of actions, and if you do the first action, you go to the first state, then second action, then the second state, and so on. For each state S on the plan, compute the relaxed plan heuristic, which is that thing that I showed you. And what is it saying? What is the number it's giving? Measure the actual distance of this step from the goal state. And since you have an actual plan in front of you, you can say that if you are the fourth state and the plan is 15 states long, then 15 minus 4 is your distance. Okay? And so now that's the delta that you're trying to predict. And so given a state, you want to predict what is this delta. And what they wind up doing is their training example for their inductive learning is features of the relaxed plan. So rather than the state, which they tried to, but the thing that seems to work better is take the relaxed plan itself and describe the relaxed plan in terms of some features. The features they use is sort of a taxonomic representation. And they then, and so on the class for each of these relaxed plans, the class level is the delta distance between what the relaxed plan heuristic is saying and what the true heuristic is saying. Okay, so you're actually computing that delta. And they essentially do a straightforward inductive learning on that, and they do quite well in terms of guessing the correct difference. Okay, and since they're doing it at the heuristic level, one of the nice things is at worst the planner would go in the wrong direction. Okay, but it'll never be giving you an unsound plan. Okay, and actually they present results showing that they do quite well, at least compared to FF, which is one of the better planners, which doesn't do learning. Okay. So one thing that to sort of complete this part of the lecture in terms of search control knowledge learning, what you could learn now are things like invariants, things saying, you know, if this, you cannot have this set of facts true in any given state, okay? You can learn simple search control rules of failure that we have talked about. You can learn adjustment rules. You can also learn retrieval rules if you are doing reuse on plans and so on. What's still open is the kinds of complex state sequence rules that TL plan uses. You can do very simple versions of that, but in general, there are now effective algorithms which can learn that sort of knowledge. And the kind of HTN schemas that SHAP, that's another knowledge-based planner, uses, that too also is not actually easy to learn right now. So those are that sort of the state of art right now in learning search control for planners. Okay. So if you remember, I was talking about this side, which is improving an existing planner to speed up planning performance. Another way of speeding up planner performance is to forget about a planner and directly learn domain-specific planners from examples. Okay. So I see enough successful plans, and I learn how to do planning in this domain. Okay, there is in fact a large amount of literature in this. In fact, this comes close to some of the reinforcement learning work that has probably been either discussed by Sachinder Singh or might be discussed by Lichtman. And I'll talk about a couple of points of contact with respect to this lecture in a minute. So learning from scratch, basically, you don't have a planner that you're trying to improve anymore. So all you care about is how do you do planning, you know, the fast way. And one idea is, say, well, all I need to know is a global policy. Okay, so what I need is for a given state and the goals, I should know what is the action to be done. So So if I am ever in a state S and my set of goals are G1 to G7, this is the action. That's it. Okay. So if you don't have these goals here, then that's just the simple Markov addition MDP policy. Now all you're doing is that MDP policy assumes that that's for a single MDP. Here you are talking about changing goals. So you're learning it over state as well as goals and learn what the action should be. Okay. And variety of approaches have been done. And if you can learn either this entire policy or approximations to it, in essence, you're learning domain-specific planner. Okay, that's one way of looking at it. The variety of approaches have been done. For example, Winner and Velasco do exploration-based learning and induction to learn domain-specific planners. We'll talk about it a little bit. Cardron did explanation-based, direct inductive learning, but he expects that the trajectories of the successful policy have been shown, which basically means large number of successful plans have been shown. And Given, Pohn, and Yoon, they do some interesting work which involves both improving, basically starting with an approximate global policy and improving it iteratively. Okay. We'll look at a couple of details of these. So the first one, learning domain-specific plans in the Winner-Velasco idea is you get a bunch of plans and you have a bunch of example plans. You try to explain, for example, why these plans are correct. So what pieces of these plans make them correct for these problems, and use that to essentially learn rules which say that when these are the initial state literals, initial state features, and these are the goal state features, these must be the action sequences you should do. Okay. The EBL part here actually occurs in doing the rationale analysis. Given a plan, you essentially try to explain why it is correct. Here's an example of the kind of things that they do. So here they are shown, I don't know if you can see it, here is shown a simple problem, a simple plan which involves this robot going into a different room, picking a red ball, coming into room one and dropping it. Okay. And they look at that sequence of states and the actions, and they learn a little rule here, which basically says whenever you have these goals and these kinds of initial state literals, this must be the sequence of actions you do. Okay. Now you have a different version here, and then that leads to a different such rule. And the inductive part essentially is trying to make sure that you kind of merge these things into a more general rule, which covers both. Okay. And you know, in essence, what they're doing in their way of computing this approximate policy of states, goals to actions is through these rules. This is the representation of their policy. So the other way of looking at it is to say that a policy can be seen as a classifier, and so we can learn it. So if we have access to n traces of an optimal policy, so if you assume that there is an optimal policy for this domain, which basically takes S and G and tells you what the action is, and you run that policy and generated traces, and you have these trajectories, you can just say that, in essence, you can say that it tells you what are the conditions, what are the states where certain actions are applicable. In each trajectory, you have state, action. And so you have examples, positive examples, saying these states, you should be doing these actions. Okay. Cardron actually, I think back in 1999, looks at this as a inductive learning problem and learns decision lists from this. Which, however, as I said, requires, of course, that you have access, there's an assumption that you have an access to an optimal policy that somebody is showing you examples of. Okay. There is some new work, actually I think this is also connected to some of the work that Gretton and co do, Gretton and Silvicevo do, but this is the one that I'm more familiar with, where you don't have access to traces from an optimal policy, so what you could do sort of is combine induction and reinforcement learning together. Okay, so you start with an approximate policy, which could be completely bad, and you do policy improvement. And when you do policy improvement, and then, so you have a policy iteration step, and then there's a policy learning step. The policy learning step here is similar to what Cardan does. And the iteration step is, if you remember the lecture by Satinder, there's basically this issue of, you know, you can do policy iteration to improve a policy from iteration to iteration. The tricky part here is to make it actually work, they wind up not doing, so if you remember the way the policy improvement is done, you convert the policy into a value function and then convert the value function back into a policy function, right? Without doing that, you could also actually just, if you only have an access to a simulator, which simulates this policy, using those trajectories, you can do approximate policy iteration, which is basically what Givan and Co. do. This is, by the way, the planner that I was mentioning yesterday, which they entered in the stochastic planning competition of IPC last year. Yesterday. Yeah, no, I think all I would like to think of EBL as basically doing a feature selection. And then there is so it's sort of a credit beam assignment using the knowledge. And then you are propagating the credit over a sequence of decisions, which is much more like the reinforcement learning part. So, I don't know, I mean, I think there are obvious connections. In fact, there is long, long back, I was actually trying to look at this paper yesterday night, obviously I couldn't, but there's a paper by Dietrich back when EBL was hot, on EBL and reinforcement learning. This would be 1990 time frame. You know, so you can look it up. Okay. So what they're doing here is, in essence, generating the trajectories for the improved policy. That's the tricky part, and the way they do it is, I mean, I'm not going to be able to go into the details, but in essence, this is a trajectory that they generated for an improved policy, starting with starting with a current policy. You do the policy iteration step, which sort of generates the trajectories for the improved policy. And once you have the trajectories for the improved policy, you can learn an approximation. You can learn essentially a closed form or a sort of a decision list form of the improved policy, which then goes back into this loop, trying to improve the policy further. And the idea of doing that here essentially is, starting from a state, they consider doing each possible action and then actually generating a simulation of the policy that they currently have. And if it doesn't end in, you know, in planning, one of the problems is in terms of looking at planning problems where there are goals of achievement as an MDP, the reward function is very sparse. All the reward is basically concentrated on the goal state. Everything else, there is nothing going on. Okay, so if these trajectories, simulation trajectories, don't actually end in a goal state, then you would not get any reward here. Instead, what they do is they actually use the relaxed plan heuristic to compute how far away are you from a goal state and use that as an approximate reward, and then that's propagated. So the basic idea would then be that you have an approximate idea of how much is the reward that you would get, expected reward, if you do A1 versus A2 versus A3, and you take the one which is the best, and take the state corresponding to that and put that there and do this entire thing again. Okay, so you are generating these trajectories of the improved, so this is essentially what's called the policy rollout. Those of you, I mean, I think Satinder Singh may have actually talked about this, I don't know. So you're essentially doing policy improvement without doing the value step in the middle, without computing the entire value function. Okay. Like I said, this is, they did do reasonably well in the stochastic planning competition, but I also talked about the fact that current day stochastic planners are pretty bad to begin with. So pretty much any sort of improvement does help a lot for them. Okay. So now I kind of go up one step. I was sort of on this all this while. Now I'm going to talk about this and end with that. The good part, of course, is this is a big one. This is a really small 2, and this is a vanishingly small 3. So you won't be spending that much time. just because there's not that much work in these areas. So in learning of the domain knowledge, which is, so the difference here you're assuming the domain knowledge is complete and correct, and all you're trying to do is improve the planner. Here you just assume that you have no domain knowledge. All you have is planners, and what you're trying to, all you have is examples of plans, and you're actually trying to learn the operator description. Okay, that's one example. Now, in learning of domain knowledge, at least there are, again, these are things that I made up to sort of differentiate in the strands of work that have been done in these areas. There's been a lot of work in learning from scratch and operator learning. So if you have, remember the blocks world was described in terms of operators, you know, the put on, put down, pick up, stack, unstack. And each of these operators have preconditions and effects. Those are their descriptions. Okay. So if you want to learn blocks world domain knowledge from examples, all you need to learn is the operators. What are the actions, what are their preconditions, what are the effects. So that's the domain physics for blocks world for you. So there is operator learning of this form that's been done a lot, both in deterministic and more recently stochastic domains, where you learn the operators from examples of successful plans. And there is also a slightly different way of looking at learning domain knowledge, where what you wind up doing is you actually have way too much domain knowledge. You have pretty large amount of knowledge of this domain. And if you start actually using it, most of, you know, this gets done a lot in the MDP community through the reinforcement learning, where if you start actually using the entire domain knowledge, your iteration steps become painfully slow. And so you try to focus on operationalizing which parts of the domain knowledge are really worth using for your plan. So here is a scenario where all you're trying to do is not use all the knowledge, okay? Another example of that, there's a lot of work in reinforcement learning. I think Doug is doing some of this stuff. Another recent example is De Jong and Levine in ICAPS 2006. You notice that there's a lot of 2006 papers in what I'm talking about, and the rest were all 1997, et cetera. That's just because there was a lot of work in planning and learning around that time, and there's again a lot of work now. There's nothing in between. I can't help it. So these guys, essentially, what they have is this interesting scenario where they are realizing that they have full knowledge, I mean, reasonably complex knowledge of how a particular, you know, how an airplane works. And their planner, however, doesn't want that complex a knowledge because it would not scale well with that much information. So in essence, given a problem and a goal, they will operationalize the parts of their domain model that will be enough for their planner to work with. And then the planner will generate a plan corresponding to that relaxed domain model, which they will then use. You know, and they actually do some interesting example of simulating the landing of a plane wherein they essentially the plan itself is generated on a cheaper model so that the planning would be faster. And then it's executed, of course, on the real world, which is, you know, more complex model. I won't talk much more about this side, but I would talk a little bit more about the operator learning stuff because it sort of fits well with the rest of the discussion that we had. In terms of learning operators and basically action models, so the problem you're faced with is given a set of problems and so given a set of examples of the following form. Each example has a problem, which is initial state, goal state, and a plan, which is an operator sequence. Because these are successful plans. Okay, problem, plan, problem, plan. Given, so you observed some of these, and if you observed some of these plans in the domain, you want to learn what must the actions be doing, really. What are their preconditions, what are their effects? So you're just learning the domain model from the examples of correct trajectories of the domain model. Okay. So in this one particular case, it's just induced operator descriptions. And obviously, the tricky part, as you will see, is this problem is under constraint in the sense there are certain aspects of it. For example, we'll see that if you know the states and actions and states and actions, okay, and it's a deterministic planning problem, then if you have a state S1, action A, state S2, then the effects of action A are very easy to guess. It's just S2 minus S1 are the effects of A. Okay, there's no learning going on. But even in that scenario, preconditions are slightly harder because it's not required that the entire state S1 was required for action A to be done. So you have multiple examples of this action being applicable, and then you figure out what is the minimal description, what's the minimal set of preconditions that are likely to be needed for this action to be applicable. In general, the kind of parameters you need to learn for the actions are preconditions and effects. And if you have a temporal action, for each effect you need to learn where is the effect likely to happen, when is it supposed to happen, and what's the duration of the action. And if you have stochastic actions, you also want to learn probabilities of the various outcomes of the action. So this learning problem becomes longer and longer. Now, it has more and more parameters being estimated depending upon the complexity of the underlying domain. Okay. So the dimensions of variation of the kinds of algorithms that have been, for this problem is, notice that I started with just the problem and the plan. Okay, the problem and the plan. Plan itself is a sequence of action, nothing else, just a sequence of action. So one dimension of variation is, do you also assume that you know the states of the world between each of the actions? So do you have complete knowledge of the state of the world and then the action, then complete knowledge of the state of the world and the action? If you have that, certain problems become much easier. Okay, so obviously it's an unrealistic assumption, knowing complete state. But at the same time, assuming that I don't know anything about the world between the actions is also unrealistic. So more likely what you would wind up having is complete state information is one extreme, no information at all about states is another extreme. A more reasonable assumption is partial observations of the states as the actions are being done. So if you are actually, stop, okay, I'll have to stop for a second. Okay. So even if the one dimension of variation in these algorithms is in the various approaches that have been tried is, do they assume full information about intermediate states, no information, or partial information? Also, do they assume no information at all about the action models, or do they assume we have partial information about the action models and I'm trying to improve the model more and more? And having partial information is sort of like having background knowledge in this particular learning problem. And that will help you sort of explain parts of why the plan works, and then that sort of focuses you on, you know, learning the rest of the preconditions and effects. One other thing that's sort of less important for this automated learning idea, but would be helpful in an interactive learning scenario, is if there's a human involved who sort of gives you feedback as to, if you have a guess as to, I think this is one of the preconditions, and if the human says, no, that's not important, then obviously that cuts down the number of iterations you have to do. The reason I put this here is, in fact, there are approaches which you make that assumption too. Here is a simple case where, here's one case where you assume full knowledge of the intermediate state, okay, for deterministic planning. And as I said, if you have full knowledge of the intermediate state, then effects are trivial to learn. Now, if I know full state S1 and full state S2, S2 minus S1 is the effect. So that's not even important to learn. Okay. The only reasonably interesting slightly more difficult one is knowing which are the preconditions of the action. So what you need is, for each example where, you know, if you have a bunch of these state sequences where this action was applicable, in essence, you would know multiple examples where here is state S1, A was applied, S2 state A was applied, S3 A was applied. So these are all the states in which A can be done, and so you're trying to induce what would have been the minimal description of the states where A actually is applicable. Okay, so that's the way you learn the preconditions. So in this scenario, you might see, so you have a state here before and then an action is done, and here's the next state. And then, of course, in terms of the effects itself, it's just a delta. Preconditions, if you just looked at this example, you'd assume that this entire state is required. Okay? But then if you look at this example too, you sort of can start seeing that not this, you know, these two are the most special states. And you can also talk about generalizations, and you can do sort of a version space of specific to general, most general and most specific preconditions that are required. where the specifics are essentially the specific states in which the action was done. Okay. And you know, if you're lucky, if the version state sort of comes close, then you have an idea of you know what the real what the preconditions for this action are, and then you know you can commit to them. There is some interesting work now more recently which tries to do this problem in the context of stochastic domains, Zettelmeyer and Kelbling and Hanna Pasula, where the problem is the same. Of course, the parameters are more now because you're actually trying to learn the probabilities of outcomes also. So, and each action might have different outcomes based on the preconditions. So the effects are no longer just these delta, I mean, the delta state tells you that in this particular scenario, this action had these effects. Okay, but then it might, in the same state, second time you do the action, it might have a different effect. And so you're sort of trying to also learn these probabilities of outcomes at the same time. So the problem at some level is the same, but it's obviously more complex because you have more parameters to deal with. There's a paper, I think they have two papers, one in 2004, 2005, ICAPS and AAAI. You could look at them for more details on operator learning in that scenario. Here is another version where a different approach, which is sort of interesting in the sense it takes the completely other extreme and says, I have no clue, whatsoever as to what the intermediate states are. Okay, all I am seeing is initial state, goal state, sequence of action. That's it. I would not require any information about the intermediate states. Now again, as I said earlier, this is also not a realistic assumption because unless you have no sensors whatsoever, you might at least know partial information about states that you actually look at in between. Okay. However, it's sort of interesting to see how the approaches would be quite different once you have this kind of an idea. This is a paper in 2005. What they wind up doing is you have a bunch of these examples, and all these example plans can be seen as constraining the hypothesis space of action models. Okay. And the kinds of constraints are that if you see a, you know, so actions, preconditions, and effects must share action parameters. So they not only look at the actions being done, but they look at the parameters of the actions being done. So if it is, it's not just put down, it'll say put down X, okay, put down A. And it's not just stack, but you would say stack AB is what is actually observed. And so they assume, so they constrain the hypothesis space in terms of these kinds of constraints. Actions, preconditions, and effects must share action parameters. And actions must have non-empty preconditions, non-empty effects, and they cannot add back what they require, they cannot delete what they didn't ask for. These are sort of reasonable constraints whose only reason is to sort of cut down the size of the hypothesis space. And then this is sort of an interesting one. You have bunches and bunches of actions appearing, and so you have multiple plans. And in different plans, there are certain actions that are occurring next to each other many, many times. So what they actually are doing is they do a frequent item set mining. I don't know if any of you know item set mining ideas. So what is the subsequences that appear more often in a large number of sequences? Okay, this is sort of a big thing. Item set mining is a big thing in data mining community. And what they do is they pick the frequent item sets or frequent sequences of actions of small size, like size 4, size 3 or 4, and then say, in fact, maybe actually in fact they say look at size 2, as I remember. And for each frequently occurring action subsequence of size 2, they sort of assume that there must be a reason why they are appearing next to each other. What might be the reason? Well, either it must be the case that if AI and AJ are occurring together all the time, AI must be giving something to AJ, or AI is deleting something that AJ would be giving to somebody else. These wind up becoming extra constraints on the action models. And what happens when you put all these action, all these constraints is you have an ugly looking SAT problem. A bunch of constraints, and each of these constraints, when they're violated, has a little delta cost, and you solve this as a max SAT problem, okay? And you know, basically find the assignment which winds up having the least amount of cost, and that would be my guess as to what are the models for the actions. And they actually do this in an iterative fashion, where once they know for sure what one, I mean, with some confidence what one action's model is, they use that in running the in learning the other actions models. The interesting thing, the reason I put this here is you can sort of see If you don't have the state description, in essence, you have a lot more of these implicit constraints, which together sort of tell you what are the action models, and sort of that's an interesting. Okay, so we're done with that. So I'm pretty much on the final stretch, and which is basically sort of open problems in this picture, which is we know how to do search control, we know how to do domain models, at least parts of it. And I sort of told you which ones are doable, which ones can't be right now. I also sort of end with some things that are actually, for various reasons, are particularly interesting to me, at least, if not to anybody else, and also a bunch of other people. And so I'll just tell you this notion of learning strategies, which in some senses, you never have full knowledge and just learn speed up. Neither do you have no knowledge and just learn the domain knowledge. What you are more likely to have is the example I started with in the beginning of my talk yesterday, where I have some knowledge about how physical things are assembled, and you show me an assembly of a reasonably complex chair or a table, just one or two times. I mean, you know how humans are. I mean, if you ever try to teach somebody how to do assemble, you're not going to show 15 assemblies to hoping that they will learn how to do assembly of a new table. You're likely to give very few example traces, And with one or two observation sequences of how a particular table is being made, I want to do as much as I can in learning, using, exploiting whatever little I know about the domain to learn pretty much all sorts of information, including how to assemble tables fast, how to learn more domain knowledge about, how to improve my domain knowledge about how to assemble tables. And so in essence, I could say, I'm just learning strategies. I might have this word strategies, which sort of improves both my speed up as well as my domain knowledge at the same time. Now, one example of that sort of thing that we looked at earlier is these task reduction schemas. One might say that if you can learn HTN schemas, that's sort of learning strategies. That doesn't really help because, as I told you, there are no very good approaches right now yet for learning HTN. But that is still a very interesting problem to solve, I think. Another one, which is also open, is basically the specific example I gave you. So you have partial domain knowledge, and how would you exploit it to sort of generate various types of knowledge from very few examples? Okay, this is sort of more of a blue sky thing at this point. This is what needs to be done. I really don't have too much of a clue as to how it's to be done, but this is a as I said earlier, there's a big project on integrated learning that's sort of been started, or would be started in US by DARPA. And their idea exactly is this. So if I give you very few examples, maybe just one, about how to do some assembly or something, how much can you learn with that single example? But the thing that makes your life easier, unlike simple inductive learning, is we do assume that there's a reasonable amount of knowledge you have about the domain. Nobody starts with zero knowledge about either assemblies or plants or anything. But you don't know exactly all the possible preconditions of all these actions, okay, or all the possible effects. At the same time, you also don't know the strategies. Oftentimes, you might know what the actions are, but you may still not know what the non-primitive actions are. Because people just show you what they're doing. They don't say, now I'm going to do the sub-assembly, and then the sub-assembly contains this part. They may not say that. If they say it will help you, a good teacher would tell you that. But if the teacher just gives you the sequence of actions, then you need to also learn the hierarchical knowledge. Okay. So, in essence, what we want to do is, given like a single example, in the worst case, just a single example, you want to analyze the heck out of this example to learn as much as you can up from that single example. Okay, using your background knowledge. So you want to learn planning operators, you want to learn task networks, you want to learn planning cases. You want to learn, obviously operators are connected to also domain uncertainty. You also want to learn strategies in terms of when to do what. Okay, so of course, with one single example, you're not going to learn everything, but the idea is to analyze the example from multiple lenses and try to figure out all these types of knowledge, some of which were speed up knowledge and some of which were domain knowledge. Okay, and I don't know how to do this. Some of the things that I do know, I sort of suggested to you earlier. Not that you would hopefully solve it for me. If you do, it would be good. But a couple of things that at least the group that we are involved with, we have been thinking about, are things like, essentially, if you look at these problems, they sort of look like good old explanation-based learning problems, except you no longer have complete knowledge. You have knowledge about the domain which is locally complete, and you, when you're trying to explain, obviously, it's not a complete and correct explanation. You still should be able to learn things from that. So, for example, one of the points I made earlier, which is characterizing the local completeness of your knowledge, and using that to decide which parts of your explanation of why the example is the way it is, or, you know, that you are confident about, and which ones you are not confident about. That could help. And in general, obviously, one other probably obvious thing should be mentioned is how to do this depends, it would pull the speed up control learning as well as domain knowledge learning approaches. So all the things that I described earlier to you should be helpful. And to some extent, as I mentioned earlier yesterday, part of the reason I decided to give this when Doug asked me was because I had to do this anyway. And you know, so I thought, you know, if I have to learn it, then I'll teach you how to do this. And you know, to the extent that's something interesting to you, you know, it'll be useful. So you basically, the kinds of challenges that we saw were domain knowledge is in different types, and so you'd wind up having different learners which are looking at the same planner at the same time, same example, and making their hypothesis, and then combining those. Learning in multiple time scales, I won't go into that. Handling partially correct domain models and explanation, so the sort of thing like, you know, an idea. The ones in red are my conjectures as to what might work. The ones in black are challenges that actually are there, you know, whether I'm right or wrong, okay, for this problem. Avoiding balkanization of the learned knowledge. This is a tricky issue. If multiple different integrated learner reasoners, we made up this word called ILRs, which are these little yellow boxes, you know, which look at, all of them independently look at this example, and they're trying to come up with why this example makes sense. And they're trying to, in doing this, they're trying to learn, you know, some subsets of these types of knowledge about the domain as well as the plan. And the problem is, how do you combine all of this into a coherent knowledge base? Because if everything is in different pieces, then it's not really going to be helpful. Okay, so that's again a pretty important challenge. We think that generally, the way you, two different people with completely different ways of looking at the world would communicate is through explanations, okay? And so that might actually wind up being helpful. And then the other thing which sort of I didn't get into here, but I guess people in machine learning are reasonably obviously familiar with, is, you know, learning, you have to sort of decide what it is that you want to learn on, okay? So if there are these multiple things, then you have a certain amount of resources and you want to decide how much of these time, you know, CPU resources you're going to expend on trying to learn task networks versus planning operators versus cases. And the way you decide this deliberate, you know, the way you actually do this resource allocation depends upon what level of knowledge do you already have. You know, so if I have nothing at all about this domain, and I mean, if my background knowledge is really low to begin with, trying to learn task networks makes no sense to me. Okay, so that, you know, that's one of these issues where, in sort of a meta-learning, where you're talking about how much to, you know, how much learning effort to put on various things. Okay, so that is something that we are looking at. Bunches of people are looking at least in terms of this project, and it sort of at least, you know, ties up the various strands of this lecture that I gave you, not by accident but by design, because I sort of made them such that the logical ending would be this. Okay. So that's basically all I have to say. I ran out of things to say. And the summary is learning methods have been used in planning for both improving search and learning domain physics. And most early work concentrated on just improving the search for good reason, because planners, even if they are given complete knowledge of the domain, were painfully slow. So they needed all the help they could get. And most recent work is concentrating sort of on learning domain physics and are adding both domain physics and speed up at the same time, sort of strategies. Okay. part of the reason for the shift is because we have a good, in planning community, we have a good handle on the search aspect. Domain-specific planner, domain-dependent planners are actually quite fast. Although I did show you that there still is a gap between domain-independent planners versus domain-customized planners, where the customization is being done by PhD recipients such as, you know, Fahim Bakas and Dana Nav. So if you spend time, you can write killer knowledge for any domain, and then you can then improve it. Now, the advantage of knowing that is not so much that, you know, that we want to lobotomize these people who could write this knowledge, but it tells you that there is this gap. So, you know, machine learning can play a part there, okay? And then most effective learning method for planning seem to be, and I sort of, and I don't have to, you know, over belabor this point, I think the general intersection of the words, the vocabulary words that were common between the lectures that preceded me and the lectures that will follow me and my lectures is sort of small. You know, if you just do, you know, Google style word count, you know, I didn't use the word kernel even once. Which, you know, I did use it once and I said, you know, not very good things about it. But so the point is that I'm trying to say is most effective learning methods that have been used in this, you know, learning and planning have seemed to be sort of very much knowledge based. And, you know, at least in the past, variants of explanation based learning have been quite popular. They're also relational most of the time. And then I sort of hope that I told you that there are many open problems in the area and you could look at them. That's it. Thanks. Done? I don't know. See, the way DARPA works right now, it's need to know basis. People know which ones. I know that I'm involved, but, you know, so, and I know who my group members are, and that's, you know, Bob is not in that, but, you know, he may be involved in some other group. So I think an interesting issue. Okay?
Bad news, my business is not coming. The story is long and complicated, but he got as far as LA after catching several planes and planes. And in LA, Qantas threw him over, saying that he didn't have his flight modified properly. So anyway, to cut a long story short, for the next session, I'm going to talk about self-observable Markov decision processes.
That's good.
Which is some of the stuff Michael is going to cover. And the proposal for what we're going to like the second session will now, well, we'll talk about this. We have 100 minutes or so, and the suggestion is that if any of you would like to talk, maybe four or five people who wanted to submit a conference presentation that you've given recently, talk about your work, if you've got open problems, it's an opportunity. Otherwise, I will find another speaker, perhaps myself or Alex, a volunteer to give another hour or so of talk. So do we have any interest?